Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the June 23rd, 2023 issue of the Week. The cover drawing of this issue is basically a cardboard box that you would put files in. Inside of the box is a diminutive Donald Trump. He's looking up at the viewer, screaming. He's got his fist clenched, and there are boxes all around him marked secret/SCI and random documents on the floor of the box. In the back left corner of the box is a golden toilet. The headline is "Caught in a Box: The Massive Multiple Impacts of Trump's Indictment." And that is our first main story, and we'll start with that. Trump charged with violating the Espionage Act. What happened? Donald Trump was arraigned in a Florida courtroom this week, becoming the first former U.S. president to be charged with federal crimes, even as he campaigns for a second term in the White House. Trump pleaded not guilty to a 37-count indictment charging that he violated the Espionage Act, obstructed justice, and put national security at risk by taking hundreds of classified documents from the White House, hoarding them at his Florida and New Jersey estates, and conspiring to hide them from investigators. The documents reportedly included top secret details of nuclear programs and America's vulnerabilities to military attack, intelligence on foreign adversaries, and a Pentagon attack plan on Iran. They were among more than 80 boxes of documents stored in locations such as a bathroom, a ballroom, and Trump's bedroom. The indictment details how Trump insisted to his own lawyers that the documents were, quote, mine, and cites an audio recording from his golf club in Bedminster in which Trump shows a visitor the Iran battle plan. As president, I could have declassified it, Trump says, in apparent contradiction of his defense that he declassified the documents. Now I can't. You know this is still a secret. During the arraignment, Smith stared directly at Trump for 20 minutes. Trump did not look back, but later assailed the prosecutor as a thug and a lunatic. Trump's former attorney general, William Barr, called Trump's claims of a witch hunt ridiculous. The indictment is very, very damning, he said. If even half of it is true, then he's toast. Many Republicans rallied around Trump. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy called the indictment a grave injustice, while others used more incendiary rhetoric. We have now reached a war phase, tweeted Representative Andy Biggs, Republican from Arizona. Eye for an eye. Carrie Lake, hailed as a rising GOP star when she ran last year for Arizona governor, said that to get Trump, prosecutors are going to have to go through me and 75 million Americans just like me. And most of us are card-carrying members of the NRA. What the editorial said: it is hard to overstate the gravity of the unprecedented moment America faces, said the New York Times. The former president is facing possible prison time even as he plots a return to the Oval Office. But Smith and his boss, Attorney General Merrick Garland, had no choice. The evidence is voluminous and paints a devastating picture of Trump's arrogant and breathtaking recklessness with some of America's most closely guarded secrets, which he treated like personal souvenirs. These actions underscore yet again why he is unfit for public office. This is a fraught moment for American democracy, said the Wall Street Journal. that the U.S. government's awesome power of prosecution would be turned on a political opponent was once unimaginable, but that seal has now been broken. Trump may have been cavalier with government secrets, but he didn't sell them to foreign countries. Smith and Garland could have just issued a report detailing Trump's misdeeds. Instead, they've taken a perilous path, and they clearly fail to understand what they've unleashed. What the columnist said, Trump's demented lawbreaking simply boggles the mind with its recklessness and arrogance, said Jeffrey Blehar in National Review. The indictment provides incredibly detailed evidence that includes recorded conversations and striking photos of top secret documents, comically insecure storage at Mar-a-Lago, piled up in a bathroom, on a stage, and in one case, spilled across the floor. Trump even expressly directed a flunky to move boxes to hide them from investigators and his own attorney. He left Smith with no choice but to charge him with crimes. There should be a high bar for prosecuting a former president, said Gary Abernathy in the Washington Post. And this case doesn't clear it. Trump hoarded the documents not to betray America, but out of a misguided sense of entitlement and a psyche that takes every confrontation as a personal challenge. The Justice Department's prosecution of President Biden's chief political rival as the 2024 campaign gets underway will roil the nation, inflame millions, and worsen our political polarization. Trump won't go down without trying to take America with him, said Thomas Friedman in the New York Times. Since he entered politics, his strategy has been to relentlessly push our system to its breaking point. He wants an America where rules are for suckers, character is meaningless, and the truth is only what he says it is. As the law bears down on this demagogue and the campaign shifts into high gear, it is impossible to exaggerate what a dangerous moment this is for our country. And our controversy of the week, also related to the Trump indictment. 2024. How should Trump's rivals handle his indictment? You'd think there'd be some kind of opportunity here, said Alexander Simon in Slate. In a normal pre-Trump world, the news that the undisputed frontrunner for a party's presidential nomination had been indicted on federal criminal charges would have rival candidates stampeding to the microphones with some variant of the message, doing federal crimes is not good, and I did not do federal crimes, which is one reason to vote for me. But following Donald Trump's indictment last week, the other GOP candidates reacted to the first federal indictment of a former president by rallying to this president's defense, with even arch-rival Ron DeSantis calling the charges a mortal threat to a free society. As jaw-dropping details from the indictment began to circulate, including Trump showing visitors military battle plans for a potential war with Iran while boasting this is secret information, some of his rivals started easing their way toward criticism, said Aaron Blake in the Washington Post. Nikki Haley called Trump extremely reckless, while DeSantis said he'd have been court-martialed in a New York minute for taking classified documents during his Navy career. But post-indictment polls show Trump's lead only widening among GOP voters, 76% of whom believe the charges are politically motivated, with 80% saying they'll vote for him even if he's convicted. Trump's rivals have a collective action problem, said David Frum in The Atlantic. They all need Republican voters to finally give up on Trump. But nobody except for kamikaze candidate Chris Christie wants to be the one to explain to the MAGA faithful that Trump's crimes are serious and disqualifying and make him all but unelectable in the 2024 general election. For each of them, the best case scenario is for someone else to do the dirty work of taking out Trump, whether it's prosecutor Jack Smith or a fellow candidate, while they pretend to be offended in hopes of inheriting his supporters. That could change, said Mona Sharin in the Bulwark. While the usual lemmings, such as House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, defended Trump this week, there were some interesting dissenters, including a half dozen Senate Republicans and Bill Barr, Trump's once loyal attorney general, who was unsparing in his criticism of the former president in a Fox News interview. He's not a victim here, Barr said. He was totally wrong that he had the right to have those documents, and hiding them from the FBI was very egregious obstruction. Republican voters have rarely heard this kind of thing from their own side before. The GOP base is sticking with Trump for now, said Noah Rothman in National Review. But if credible Republicans like Barr and Trump's 2024 rivals can find the guts to press the case that running an indicted or convicted Trump will ensure Joe Biden's reelection, those core voters could quickly rethink their allegiance. Dream on, said Zach Bocamp in Vox. Trump's cult-like following has come to believe that the woke power elite are on a mission to destroy them and the conservative way of life. They have been radicalized against the core institutions of America, from our justice system to elections to democracy itself. In their view, you are either with us or against us. Trump's 2024 campaign will be about getting vengeance on his persecutors by any means necessary, and they will not accept defeat. Make no mistake, if other Republicans don't stop Trump, our democracy is in mortal peril. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for artificial reunions after Paul McCartney announced that the Beatles will release their final record this year, featuring vocals of the late John Lennon extracted from an old demo cassette using AI tools. McCartney, 80, said AI is exciting because it's the future. It was a good week for the local pizza joint. After Zoom, an automated pizza company that used robots to make its pies inside delivery trucks, shut down. Launched with nearly $500 million in venture capital funding, Zoom and its robots never mastered the art of delivering a hot pizza without the cheese sliding off. And it was a good week for strength in numbers. After female fans of mega pop star Taylor Swift, who vastly outnumber males on her current tour, have taken over men's rooms to shorten the time it takes to pee. But it was a bad week for umami. After Japanese sushi chain Sushiro sued a teenager seen in a viral video surreptitiously licking a soy sauce dispenser and wiping his saliva on a piece of fish in one of its restaurants. The unnamed bioterrorist caused a sharp drop in Sushiro's business. It was a bad week for pride. After trans activist Rose Montoya flashed her breast during a family-friendly Pride Month celebration on the White House lawn, Montoya's display was inappropriate and disrespectful, said a White House spokesperson. And it was a bad week for bedside manner. After a report that some doctors are now using ChatGPT to help them break the bad news to terminal patients. I wish there were more and better treatments, goes one suggested script. And I hope that in the future, there will be. The title of this week's briefing is AI, the worst case scenario. Artificial intelligence's architects warn it could cause human extinction. How might that happen? What are AI experts afraid of? They fear that AI will become so super intelligent and powerful that it becomes autonomous and causes mass social disruption or even the eradication of the human race. More than 350 AI researchers and engineers recently issued a warning that AI poses risks comparable to those of pandemics and nuclear war. In a 2022 survey of AI experts, the median odds they placed on AI causing extinction or the severe disempowerment of the human species were 1 in 10. This is not science fiction, said Jeffrey Hinton, often called the godfather of AI, who recently left Google so he could sound a warning about AI risks. A lot of smart people should be putting a lot of effort into figuring out how we deal with the possibility of AI taking over. When might this happen? Hinton used to think the danger was at least 30 years away, but says AI is evolving into a superintelligence so rapidly that it may be smarter than humans in as little as 5 years. AI-powered ChatGPT and Bing's chatbot already can pass the bar and medical licensing exams, including essay sections, and on IQ tests score in the 99th percentile. Genius level. Hinton and other doomsayers fear the moment when artificial general intelligence, or AGI, can outperform humans on almost every task. Some AI experts liken that eventuality to the sudden arrival on our planet of a superior alien race. You have no idea what they're going to do when they get here, except that they're going to take over the world, said computer scientist Stuart Russell, another pioneering AI researcher. How might AI actually harm us? One scenario is that malevolent actors will harness its power to create novel bioweapons more deadly than natural pandemics. As AI becomes increasingly integrated into the systems that run the world, terrorists or rogue dictators could use AI to shut down financial markets, power grids, and other vital infrastructure, such as water supplies. The global economy could grind to a halt. Authoritarian leaders could use highly realistic AI-generated propaganda and deepfakes to stoke civil war or nuclear war between nations. In some scenarios, AI itself could go rogue and decide to free itself from the control of its creators. To rid itself of humans, AI could trick a nation's leaders into believing an enemy has launched nuclear missiles so that they launch their own. Some say AI could design and create machines or biological organisms like the Terminator from the film series to act out its instructions in the real world. It's also possible that AI could wipe out humans without malice as it seeks other goals. How would that work? AI creators themselves don't fully understand how the programs arrive at their determinations, and an AI tasked with a goal might try to meet it in unpredictable and destructive ways. A theoretical scenario often cited to illustrate that concept is an AI instructed to make as many paperclips as possible. it could commandeer virtually all human resources to the making of paperclips. And when humans try to intervene to stop it, the AI could decide eliminating people is necessary to achieve its goal. A more plausible real-world scenario is that an AI tasked with solving climate change decides that the fastest way to halt carbon emissions is to extinguish humanity. It does exactly what you wanted it to do, but not in the way you wanted it to, explained Tom Shivers, author of the book on the AI threat. Are these scenarios far-fetched? Some AI experts are highly skeptical AI could cause an apocalypse. They say our ability to harness AI will evolve as AI does, and that the idea that algorithms and machines will develop a will of their own is an overblown fear influenced by science fiction, not a pragmatic assessment of the technology's risks. But those sounding the alarm argue that it's impossible to envision exactly what AI systems far more sophisticated than today's might do, and that it's short-sighted and imprudent to dismiss the worst-case scenarios. So, what should we do? That's a matter of fervent debate among AI experts and public officials. The most extreme Cassandras call for shutting down AI research entirely. There are calls for moratoriums on its development, a government agency that would regulate AI, and an international regulatory body. AI's mind-boggling ability to tie together all human knowledge, perceive patterns and correlations, and come up with creative solutions is very likely to do much good in the world, from curing diseases to fighting climate change. But creating an intelligence greater than our own could lead to darker outcomes. The stakes couldn't be higher, said Russell. How do you maintain power over entities more powerful than you forever? If we don't control our own civilization, we have no say in whether we continue to exist. Moving into the best columns of the week, we'll start with two from the U.S. First up, when public schools teach dogma. Many conservatives have decided that the First Amendment can be discarded in order to win the culture war, said David French. This authoritarian version of conservatism has led Oklahoma State Charter Board officials to approve the nation's first religious charter school, where the teaching of Catholic Church doctrine will be fully funded by taxpayers. The First Amendment's Establishment Clause forbids the government from promoting specific religions. But a substantial segment of the right now believes that someone's worldview will control our schools, so it should be theirs. They are advocating using public education to promote Christianity, which is blatantly unconstitutional. The right, however, is not alone in wanting to use education as indoctrination rather than giving students the freedom to think for themselves. California's state university system is now being sued for requiring mandatory diversity, equity, and inclusion, DEI statements, from candidates applying for jobs. Evidence strongly suggests that these DEI statements are being used as ideological litmus tests for new faculty hires, with applicants being immediately rejected if they don't echo progressive dogma. As the right and the left become more extreme, they become more alike. Democrats' electoral pact invites chaos. Imagine a January 6th style crisis over a presidential election, but with genuine uncertainty over which candidate has won several states' electoral votes, said Jason Willick. That disturbing scenario could be a reality if enough Democratic states sign onto a voluntary agreement called the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. Already, 16 states have passed legislation to join the compact, pledging to award their Electoral College votes to the candidate who wins the national popular vote, even if that candidate lost that state. The pact takes effect once states carrying 270 combined electoral votes, the threshold to win the presidency, sign on. Preventing popular vote losers from winning the White House might seem like a worthy goal, but holding a presidential election under a patchwork of laws would open a Pandora's box. Red and blue states would be at one another's throats over their differing election policies, and members of Congress could balk at accepting slates of electors that don't match state results. In 2020, Trump showed how a determined presidential loser can create a crisis in the post-election period. The last thing we need is a popular vote pact that creates more paths to crisis. This column is from Sweden. Why not toot our horn for once? We Swedes like to keep nationalism at a distance, said Inger Jagerhorn. We think of it as something ugly, a narrow-minded, warlike impulse that fuels the rise of tyrants like Vladimir Putin and Viktor Orban. But as we recognize this month, the 500th anniversary of our nation's unification under King Gustav Vasa, why must we keep hiding our pride at the nation we've become? Maybe because we know deep down that we are the best, and so we think it goes without saying. After all, Sweden regularly tops indexes of the world's most democratic nations. We have a strong welfare state, yet we also excel at innovation. On human rights and other issues, our word carries weight internationally. But taking all this for granted may not be the best idea anymore. Not when the far-right Sweden Democrats are draping themselves in blue and yellow, trying to co-opt the Swedish flag as an exclusive symbol of their party propaganda. Our neighbors Norway and Finland have yearly displays of open national pride, and that has not turned them into North Korea. If we can count democracy and equality as long-standing Swedish traditions, why not celebrate them? There are exciting things to highlight here, things to be proud of, things to flag. And it's time for the last word, our feature article, titled this week, When the Tsunami Comes. Seismologists warn that a massive earthquake will someday hit the Northwest, triggering a wall of water 60 feet high, said Eric Scigliano in Politico. A Coast Guard station is the only line of defense. On the north shore of Washington's wild Olympic Peninsula, scimitar-shaped sand spit called Edis Hook arcs for 3 miles into the Strait of Juan de Fuca. At its tip between Snowy Mountains to the south and Vancouver Island to the north sits what might be the nation's most scenically sited military installation, and its most vulnerable. U.S. Coast Guard Air Station Port Angeles is the very first of first responders when something goes wrong, as it often does on the state's tangled straits and inlets and stormy outer coast, and sometimes on the peaks and bluffs overlooking them. The station's three MH-65 Dolphin helicopters are the only aircraft of the Coast Guard, America's frontline coastal defense and search and rescue service, bases along Washington's 3,026-mile coastline. In 2021, they undertook 195 search and rescue missions. Edith's Hook is also home base for four seagoing cutters, 87 to 110 feet long, and one 210-foot medium endurance cutter, plus two short-range response boats to deal with local emergencies. Many Coast Guard rescues are routine. Boats adrift with stalled motors, empty gas tanks or scrambled navigational equipment. Others become Discovery Channel legend. One helicopter pilot, Lieutenant Thomas Loftus, told me about his first, a father and son who got swept out into Bellingham Bay, 70 miles away, on a little John boat one January night when the temperature was 24 degrees and the wind blew 40 miles an hour. "We got there in 30 minutes," Loftus said proudly. But those exploits are just a warm-up for the disaster to come. Someday, next week, next year, maybe next century, a sudden and deadly marine shock will strike the northwest coast, what locals call the big one, a circa magnitude 9.0 offshore earthquake generating tsunami surges reaching 60 feet high or more. Just how ready Coast Guard rescuers are for the big wave to come is a question with life and death implications for them and for those they defend. As Lieutenant Kyle Cuddy, who was the station's communications officer when I first visited nearly 8 years ago, told me, "It's hard to say whether we'll be first responders or victims." About 130 miles west of Edith's Hook, 70 miles past the outer coast, two slabs of planetary crust are locked in a titanic struggle. One, the offshore Juan de Fuca plate, is what's left of a continent-sized plate that has for the past 200 million years been intermittently sliding under the larger North American plate, an actual continent, in a process called subduction. The Cascadia subduction zone thus formed stretches for more than 700 miles. From California's Cape Mendocino past the northern tip of Canada's Vancouver Island, the sliding under movement of subduction is very different from the side-to-side grinding of the San Andreas Fault to the south. There, frequent movements experienced as earthquakes release tectonic tension before it builds to a catastrophic levels. Along the subduction zone, however, this tension builds for hundreds of years and releases with explosive force. The greatest strain has accumulated off Washington, making it the likeliest target zero for the next megaquake and tsunami. When the Juan de Fuca plate jams farther under North American plate, it will push it up 30 feet or more and displace vast quantities of seawater, and a tsunami will be born. The last Cascadia earthquake with an estimated magnitude of 9.0 occurred around 9 p.m. on January 26, 1700, a date known precisely thanks to meticulous Japanese records of an extraordinary orphan tsunami with no known source. Native peoples on this side of the Pacific, from California's Yurok to the Nootka north of Vancouver Island, told corroborating tales of a great shaking and the sea pouring in and taking everything in its path. The Ho and Quelete, who live at two of the most vulnerable points on Washington's Olympic coast, credited the waves to a titanic battle between whale and thunderbird. But the Pacific Northwest written history didn't begin until the late 1700s. In these oral histories, together with a native tradition of locating villages safely upland from the beach, were ignored. It wasn't until the 1980s that scientists began piecing together the region's violent seismic history. They've now identified more than 40 earthquakes along the subduction zone in the past 10,000 years. Megaquakes of magnitudes 8.7 plus, capable of generating large tsunamis, have averaged 430-year intervals. Five appear to have reached the magnitude 9.1 of Japan's 2011 Tohoku, the Fukushima earthquake, and the 2004 Sumatran quake, whose tsunami killed 228,000 people in 11 countries. After 323 quiet years, another could strike any time. When it does, it will send waves surging outward at initial speeds of up to 600 miles an hour. Less than an hour after the quake, they will inundate the coast up to an elevation of 100 feet above sea level in some spots, more typically 30 to 60 feet, depending on water depth, tides, and other factors. They will sweep up buildings, trees, vehicles, people. Anyone along the shore who feels the shaking will need to head immediately for high ground, and they will need to do so on foot. Roads will likely be damaged, and even if they aren't, traffic will quickly snarl. Those who dawdle, walk too slowly, or pause to collect keepsakes or help the injured will court disaster. According to Washington's Emergency Management Division, 112,555 residents of the four counties lining Washington's ocean coast and the Strait of Juan de Fuca live in the inundation zone, land that tsunami waves will overrun. Earlier benchmarks suggest that 23% will be unable to reach higher ground in time, and 18%, perhaps 20,000 people, more than 10 times the number who died in Hurricane Katrina, will be washed out to sea or crushed by debris. U.S. Geological Survey data and the current scientific consensus suggest a 15 to 24% likelihood that such a megaquake will occur in the next 50 years. Just outside the gates of the Edis Hook Coast Guard Station, about 2.5 miles out on the spit, sits a second vital marine safety operation, the Puget Sound Pilots. The pilots are 50-plus elite mariners who shuttle out into the Strait of Juan de Fuca to meet the freighters, tankers, and cruise ships steaming towards Seattle and other ports, and guide them through the twisting channels of the Salish Sea. Each year they guide about 7,000 passages, inbound or outbound, carrying $80 billion in cargo between Adis Hook and the ports on Puget Sound. For years, both the pilots and coasties assumed that when the ground started shaking, they would escape the hook the way they came to work, driving out the two-lane road to the mainland. That's in keeping with the traditional advice for those living in what's called the inundation zone. As soon as you get the warning, shaking ground, a blaring alarm, the sea pulling back from the shore, hurry to the highest ground you can find. A land exit might be a reasonable response for the more common sort of waves generated by a distant earthquake or volcanic eruption, most likely in Alaska. Not so for the much larger tsunami generated by a Cascadia subduction zone quake, which would arrive in an hour or less after the shaking starts. The shaking, which can last as long as 5 minutes, will also eat into the short window of time before the wave arrives. It will likely make driving impossible and walking and running difficult. The U.S. Geological Survey calculates that it would take 90 to 100 minutes to walk from the Coast Guard station to safe ground on the mainland. nearly twice as long as the tsunami will take to arrive. A runner could make it if the way is clear and he or she can sustain the pace for nearly 4 miles. But the pilot's case is also special. They have 2 70-foot boats that they use to meet incoming ships and deboard from outbound ones, and those vessels will be needed for the recovery. In early 2015, the pilots decided to conduct a trial escape in the opposite direction, out to sea. They decided to invite their coastie neighbors to participate. On a crystalline morning, about 55 officers and seamen mustered around the Coast Guard station's flagpole. Lieutenant Cuddy introduced Ian Miller, a geomorphologist and expert on coastal hazards, who explained the hazards and choices involved and concluded, "I want you to be safe. More important, I want you to be functional so you can save me and my family." Cuddy and a few other coasties then trooped down to the pilot's dock and boarded their boat, which shoved off. They rounded the hook and made it to safe water in 16 minutes. That was encouraging, but no guarantee they'd be able to get there under actual quake conditions. Escaping tumbled buildings, gathering personnel scattered around various facilities, crossing jumbled sunken ground and roiling water. The boats would have nearly no time to stop at the Coast Guard station's docks on the way out. Rather than reducing their stake at Eda's Hook, the armed forces have compounded it. In 2015, just as tsunami concerns were heating up, the U.S. Navy announced it would build a new Maritime Force Protection Unit pier and support complex at the Coast Guard base. This facility, completed in 2018, serves as an advance base for the armed escort ships that protect the 8 Trident submarines, which bear an estimated quarter of the nation's nuclear arsenal, as they shuttle between their base at Bangor, Washington, and the open sea. Bangor, situated on a long fjord called the Hood Canal, is shielded from tsunamis. The escort station that guards the subs is not. The Puget Sound pilots were aghast at this decision. Then they began to see possibilities. Unlike the pilots' much smaller response boats, which would strain and perhaps fail to evacuate everyone from the hook, just one of the 250-foot escort ships could easily accommodate everyone likely to be on the sandbar. The escort vessels are also kept ready to go at all times. They're docked beside the Coast Guard facilities and could load their personnel faster. The pilots would love to pass rescue honors on to the Maritime Force Protection Unit. "Now that they have those Navy ships, we want to make sure we're not the first line of defense," said Pilots President Ivan Carlson. "We'd like to be there just as a backup." But they have no idea whether the Navy facility is ready to take on that responsibility. Repeated email and phone inquiries to Naval Base Kitsap Bangor, the sub's home port, brought no substantive response save one public document that's no longer posted online: the final environmental assessment for the Eda's Hook facility. All it says about tsunami hazards is, in the event of a tsunami, for all action alternatives, personnel at the TPS, Transit Protection System, pier, and on TPS vessels docked at the pier would follow the USCG Emergency Response Plan in force at the air station. Senior Coast Guard officers also referred me to that plan, called the Sector Puget Sound Natural Disaster Plan, saying it would clarify the agency's tsunami strategies. I filed an obligatory FOIA request for it, which bounced between local, regional, and national Coast Guard offices before being rejected on what seemed flimsy grounds. I appealed, and 5 months after filing, finally obtained the plan last August, with minor redactions. It defines missions, roles, communications, and emergency contingencies for natural threats ranging from heavy weather to earthquakes, tsunamis, and volcanic eruptions. But it looks toward a smaller local quake along a Puget Sound area fault or a tsunami generated by an Alaskan quake, which would give several hours warning. It does not contemplate a Cascadia megaquake immediately followed by a tsunami. This outdated, inadequate plan may soon be replaced. Since I made my inquiries last August, the District 13 administration has formed a tsunami working group with members from the Washington and Oregon sectors, as well as district specialists. The new plan is expected to be completed this autumn. Sometime after that, the Coasties, for the first time, will conduct their own trial evacuation, nearly 10 years after the pilots first invited them aboard theirs. Meanwhile, 130 miles to the west, a kilometer deep beneath the dark Pacific, the North American and Juan de Fuca plates continue their long, slow dance, building to a catastrophic release. This was adapted from an article first published by Politico. We read one of the obituaries. The domestic terrorist known as the Unabomber, Ted Kaczynski, 1942-2023. The malign influence of Ted Kaczynski went beyond the people he killed and maimed from 1978 to 1995. A Harvard-educated math prodigy, he became a domestic terrorist, responsible for more bombing attacks than anyone else in U.S. history. The effort to stop him was the country's longest and most expensive manhunt, and he forced the publication of his 35,000-word manifesto, Industrial Society and Its Future, an anti-technology screed that won him a cult following and inspired similar attacks. In 1995, he vowed to blow up a plane unless the New York Times and the Washington Post agreed to publish the tract. Under pressure from federal authorities, they did. Pretending to be part of a militant group rather than a lone wolf, in the missive he defended the attacks that left 3 dead and 23 injured, claiming he had to kill people to get his message out. Kaczynski was raised in the Chicago area by parents who emphasized academic excellence above all else, said the Washington Post. Socially awkward, he scored above 165 on IQ test, skipped 2 grades, and was admitted to Harvard at age 16. But his isolation deepened on campus, where he was one of 22 students subjected to a manipulative psychological study under Project MKUltra, the CIA experiment with mind control. Kaczynski got a PhD in geometry at the University of Michigan with a dissertation said to be comprehensible by 10 to 12 people in the country, said the Telegraph. He taught briefly at Berkeley before moving to Montana in 1971, where he went off-grid to prep his terrorist attacks. The first 2 bombs hit 2 people at Northwestern University in 1978. The following year, he planned a smoke-sputtering bomb on an airplane that sickened 12 passengers. The FBI called the attacker UNABOM for University and Airline Bomber. During his frightening slow-motion 18-year rampage, said the Los Angeles Times, Kaczynski fed investigators false clues, taunting them like a comic book villain. He was ultimately betrayed by his own words. His brother and sister-in-law noticed similarities between the manifesto and long rambling letters he sent them. They went to the FBI, and in April 1996, authorities raided his shack, finding a giant stash of bomb-making material. A court psychologist diagnosed Kaczynski with paranoid schizophrenia, but found him competent to stand trial. He pleaded guilty to murder in 1998 and received 8 life sentences, serving most of his time in a federal supermax prison in Colorado. He was found dead of apparent suicide at the North Carolina Prison Medical Center he was moved to in 2021. Kaczynski's crimes enjoyed an afterlife few would have predicted in the 1990s, in the New York Times. Norwegian terrorist Anders Behring Breivik lifted whole passages from the Unabomber Manifesto for his own before committing his 2011 massacre. And Kaczynski's ideas were later echoed by anarchist, eco-terrorist, and other fringe figures. But to his victims, the attacks will never be anything but senseless, said CNN. There's never closure, said Charles Epstein, who lost 3 fingers and much of his hearing in a 1993 mail bomb attack that also left him with abdominal injuries. Every time I look at my hand, it's still there. Here's a business column. Sports washing. Golf gets a Saudi makeover. It was a shocking reversal that left PGA golfers and loyal golf fans incredulous and furious, said Alan Blinder in the New York Times. The PGA last week cut a deal with LIV Golf, an upstart league funded with Saudi Arabia's $620 billion sovereign wealth fund. The Saudis had started a war by poaching star golfers like Phil Mickelson and Brooks Koepka with lucrative contracts. Amid widespread belief that the Saudis were trying to sports wash their terrible human rights record, PGA Commissioner Jay Monahan had spent months trying to sow moral doubts about LIV Golf. But behind the scenes, Monahan was worried that the war with LIV had left the PGA in deep peril. Legal fees to fight LIV Golf's antitrust lawsuit had swelled to $50 million a year. The tour's efforts to retain the loyalty of players such as Rory McIlroy by raising prize purses were also severely straining its finances. So a PGA board member began making overtures to the governors of the Saudis' wealth fund, Yasir al-Rumayyan. After 7 weeks of clandestine meetings, al-Rumayyan was named chairman of a new enterprise aligning the 3 biggest forces of professional golf: the PGA Tour, LIV Golf, and the DP World Tour, under a Saudi umbrella. Sad day, said Bill Plaschke in the Los Angeles Times. Next time you spend a Sunday afternoon curled up on the couch watching golf, understand it has been brought to you by a country with no free speech, no religious freedom, and a history of discriminating against women. Fans are rightfully fuming that Saudi Arabia now owns golf. The creation of LIV exposed how many people in golf have a worldview that extends no farther than the perimeter of their purses, said Eamon Lynch in Golf Week. Now the entire sport is acting as a pawn for a murderous regime, one that ordered the gruesome murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The PGA has become a willing platform for human rights abusers to launder their wrongdoing. The merger may also be illegal, said sports law professor Mark Edelman in The Atlantic. Monahan foolishly said the deal with the Saudis was a way to take the competitor off the board, a textbook lesson in why antitrust laws were passed. The PGA Tour says the Saudi backing will benefit players. Don't believe it. Without competition, the incentive to pay players more disappears. The Justice Department or Federal Trade Commission will likely sue. If this deal does go through, it may be the tip of the iceberg for the Saudis, said Andrew England in the Financial Times. Saudi Arabia sees itself as the center of a new world order, and it has identified sports as one of the key sectors to champion Saudi Arabia's brand overseas. Saudi Arabia's Sovereign Wealth Fund has acquired the English soccer club Newcastle United and formed a domestic soccer league headlined by Cristiano Ronaldo. Outside sports, the Saudi fund is taking on mega projects from dominating the gaming industry to starting a new airline. The Sovereign's fund's financial power is now luring some who are wary of doing business with Riyadh because of its dire human rights record. And that's exactly the goal. And with just a few moments left in the show, we'll go to the poll watch. 76% of likely GOP primary voters say they are more concerned that Donald Trump's indictment was politically motivated than they are about any risk to national security he may have created by taking classified documents. Only 7% say the indictment hurts their opinion of the former president. And we'll take two quotes. First up, Gary Trudeau says, commencement speeches were invented largely in the belief that outgoing college students should never be released into the world until they have been properly sedated. And finally, from Joan Didion, character, the willingness to accept responsibility for one's own life is the source from which self-respect springs. And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you have enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.